Welcome to Dinosaur George Kids, a show for anyone who loves dinosaurs. Dinosaur George has studied paleontology for over 50 years and has performed live to over 4 million students across the world. So sit back and enjoy today's show. Now, here's Dinosaur George.
Well, hey there, future paleontologists. I'm Dinosaur George, and welcome to the podcast. Happy New Year to you all. I mean, it's already the middle of January, and I'm wishing everybody a Happy New Year, but I always run behind, and that's one of the difficult things about my traveling so much, is it makes it really, really difficult to be able to do these podcasts as many as I had hoped to do. This podcast is on Panoplosaurus, which is a very interesting dinosaur, and I think you're going to love him even more, love it even more afterwards. A couple of things I want to do. First of all, while I'm recording this podcast, I'm doing a live feed at the Dinosaur George Kids Facebook group page. And if you would like to, I try to do more and more of those as I can. I'm trying to record video of me recording the podcast and doing a live feed at Dinosaur George Kids. So if you'd like to join that group or follow that Facebook group page, it's Dinosaur George Kids, and there's no cost. We try to keep it very family friendly, and it's very safe. So it's a cool place. Speaking of that, I wanted to give a shout out to some of the different people out there. One is Emilio Raptor, who's watching, who Emilio and I have been friends for absolutely forever. And Logan Raptor, my good friend Matt's son, Logan. I'd like to give a shout out to Logan. Also one to Rhodey, who I've known for a very long time. And then little Luke. Luke, there's your shout out. A couple of other things I want to talk about. If you become a member of our Patreon club and you are a Raptor or a T-Rex member, it's very, very important that you give us your mailing address when you sign up, because you get welcome gifts when you join one of those two clubs. But sometimes people don't give us their mailing address. And I understand why. You concerns of safety or thoughts that you're going to start getting a bunch of stuff mailed to you. That's not the case. We don't sell our mailing list. We don't share our mailing list. So please make sure to give us an address where we can send your welcome gifts. Now, normally we send the welcome gifts out once a month, usually at the beginning of a month. So if you join, let's say you joined January 3rd, it may be February before we mail your gift out. And then also for so many of you who are overseas, we can't control what happens once we ship the product. In fact, it's almost impossible for us to track when it goes overseas. We can get notification of where it went and when it left the United States. But from there, it becomes very difficult. I know there's a lot of listeners in Australia who we ship to, and some of it is hit and miss. Sometimes they get them very quickly. Sometimes it takes months to get there. But just be aware that if you become a Patreon club member, either a T-Rex or a Raptor member, there could be some delay in getting your welcome gifts based on when you sign up and where you sign up from. All right. So a couple of other shout outs I want to do. This one is kind of cool. Percy Saurus, who listens to our podcast on Spotify every night at bedtime. Percy Saurus found out or saw on the report she has listened to 28,391 minutes of our podcast in 2023. She was one of the 1% top listeners. The number one listener. That's incredible. And speaking of numbers, I still can't get over this. We eclipsed 1 million downloads of this podcast. 1 million downloads of this podcast. It's still mind-boggling to me. It's absolutely amazing. So anyway, special shout-out to Percy Saurus. who listens that much. And then also, a couple of weekends ago, I was out at the museum and store out at Trader's Village in San Antonio, and I met a family who was traveling from Portland, Oregon, all the way across the country to Florida to go to the friendliest place in the world, Disney. And I met Runic, Cairo, Indy, Cora, and their mom. I just want to say how much I enjoyed meeting you guys. I hope you had a safe trip. I hope you're safely down there enjoying yourself. And if you do come back through Texas, through San Antonio, hopefully I'll get a chance to see you all again. I hope you enjoyed coming to the museum, and I hope you enjoyed the store. All right. One of the benefits of being a Patreon Club member in our Tyrannosaurus Rex group, that one of the benefits is getting a birthday shout out. And I need to do the January birthday shout outs. I'm sure I did December shout outs. I'm sure I did. Didn't I? I had to have done December birthday shout-outs. I hope I did. If I didn't, I'm in big trouble. I'll do those. I'll find out when from some of you who are Patreon Club members. If I forgot December shout-outs, oh my gosh, send me a message through Patreon and I will fix that immediately. So let's get into it. Levi T-Rex turned 7 on January the 2nd. Plesio Lakenlinosaurus, what a great name, turned 8, or will turn 8, on January 25th. Casey Soros will turn 6 on the 12th of January. That was just, what's today's date? That was 2 days ago. Happy birthday, man. Milesosaurus turned 6, January the 8th. Giganota Gibson turns 10 on January 21st. Annabellosaurus turns 9 on January the 30th. Arthur Tenosaurus turns 8 on January 31st. Tiber turned 8 January 4th. Agnosaurus Rex will turn 8 on January 18th. David Raptor turned 6 on January 4th. Rhys Rex turned 7 on January 19th. Henry Peterson turned 6 on January 23rd. Kadiosaurus Rex is turned 7 on January 10th. Velasa Addy turned 8 on January 1st, and that was her one-year anniversary of being a T-Rex member. Westernosaurus will be 9 on January 25th. Raja Grammus will be 11 on the 30th of January. That's cool. Percysaurus turns 8 on January 6th. I think I already did that one. Didn't I already mention you, Percysaurus? No, I didn't. I didn't give you your... Oh, I didn't give you your birthday shout-out. I mentioned you, but I didn't give you your birthday shout-out. That's kind of cool. That's really kind of cool. All right. So happy birthday. Apteryx Rex turns 6 on January 4th. Aiden Ball is turning 6 on the 14th. Isn't today like the 13th? No, today is the 14th. Hey, how cool. Ionch Rex is turning 7 on January 21st. Ionch loves Tarbosaurus. Zoe will turn 5 on January 26th. Ira Raptor is turning 8 on January 23rd. Let's see. Meiosaurus Rex will turn 6 on January 20th. And James E. Rex is turning 4 on January the 30th. Now, some of you joined our podcast just recently, and we didn't get to give your shout out. So, Moriceratops turned 4 on October 30th. Hunter Rex turned 5 on November 17th. And let's see. Jenningsaurus Rex turned 7 on December 13th. So I'm sorry that I missed those dates. Or it could be that you just joined right after we did them. So anyway, hopefully that will make it up to you. All right. So shout outs to all of you. Again, if you would like to become a Patreon member, go to our website, dinosaurgeorge.com. Click on the Patreon Club and there's a link there and you can join. You can become a Triceratops member for only $1 a month. With that, you get one live lesson that I teach for all members once a month. And you get to participate in some of the different games and the different things that we're doing over at Patreon. If you become a Raptor Club member, that's $5 a month. You get a welcome gift of a Raptor Claw replica, which is the Killing Claw. You get two live lessons per month, and you get access to all the details and information of what's going on. And then if you are a T-Rex member, that is $10 a month. You get a birthday shout out. You get your name is randomly chosen to be on podcasts periodically. We interview people for podcasts. You get two live lessons per month. Plus, you get a lot of behind the scenes things that other people don't get to see. And then you also get to ask your who would wins. So anyway, if you would like to become a member of the Patreon Club, it certainly helps us financially continue to do these podcasts. And so I appreciate that very, very much. And it allows us to make the podcast free for everybody. Okay, let's get down and talk about our
feature creature.
It's time for our feature creature segment. If you would like to suggest a creature, go to the Dinosaur George Kids podcast page at dinosaurgeorge.com or post your suggestion on the Dinosaur George Kids Facebook group page. Now, here is your feature creature.
All right. Again, I am broadcasting this or streaming this live on our page, so periodically you may hear me mention somebody. Like Tori, who's always joining. Narisa, it looks like you guys just woke up. So good morning to you. And Amy, I'm so glad that Luke was glad to hear a shout out from me on the live feed. All right, today's feature creature is Panoplosaurus mirus. All animals have a first and last scientific name. When you see the name of an animal, you'll see its first name is capitalized. That is its genus name. And then the species name is like its last name. And that's never a capital letter. That's always lowercase. This animal's name is Panoplosaurus mirus. And in English, that means well-armored lizard. And I'll explain why in a minute. This is a quadruped herbivore, meaning quadruped means how many legs it walks on. There are three kinds of movement on land: quadruped, biped, or semi-biped or semi-quadruped. What that basically means is bipedal means to walk on two legs. Quad means four. Quadrupedal means to walk on four legs. Semi means sometimes. So semi-biped would mean that an animal walks on four legs, but that it could stand up and walk on two. McAllister family, how are you? Glad you guys are a T-Rex member. This animal is a quadruped walking on four legs. You know, on a bicycle, what do you put your foot on to make it move? A pedal. So ped is a word that sort of means walk or step. So quadruped means walks on four legs. Tori just said Pineapplesaurus doesn't like pizza. There is no Pineapplesaurus, and if there was, it has no business being on pizza. Pineapple does not go on pizza. I just said that. There, I've said it. It is an herbivore, meaning that it eats plants. Now, this is an animal that is related to the ankylosaurs. Ankylosaurs are those dinosaurs that have armor on their back, walk on four legs. Some of them have a club on their tail, some don't. Well, they divide that family into two groups. They divide them into the ankylosaurs and the nodosaurs. Nodosaur, when I was a kid, the way I remembered what a nodosaur was is they have no club on their tail. So I always remember nodosaur, no club. Well, ankylosaurs and nodosaurs have that separation. There's some other features, but that's the most recognizable one. So, Panoplosaurus does not have a club on his tail. Therefore, it belongs to the nodosaur group. These animals lived in the late Cretaceous between 76 to 75 million years ago. It's a relatively big animal. It's 5 meters long. That's 16 feet. It weighs 1,600 kilos, which is 3,500 pounds in weight. So that's a pretty hefty animal. It's a pretty big animal. I would venture to say that it is longer than anybody's vehicle, whatever your parents drive, unless they happen to drive an 18-wheeler. So it's a relatively big animal. It's a heavy animal. One of the things that a lot of them think about, I mean, a lot of them do, is they rely on their weight as one of their means of defense. In most cases, the stomach area is not armored. That would be its weak spot. But when you weigh 3,500 pounds or 1,600 kilograms, you can't be picked up and rolled over very easily. There's not any carnivores with that sort of strength that they could use their arms for that. So it's also considered a weapon. It was discovered in Alberta, Canada in 1917, and it was described in 1919. For those of you that listen to the podcast, you know what I mean when I say described. If you're new to the podcast, let me explain what that means. When a new species of dinosaur is discovered, when they find something that nobody's ever found before, scientists have to demonstrate that it is indeed a new species. And they do that by describing it. That means on paper, they write a very detailed scientific paper that will help prove the hypothesis that it is a new dinosaur. They have to do that. Sometimes that can take a long time because they have to compare the bones that they found to something that it's closely related to so that they know what family to put it in. That takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time for somebody to do that. You have to describe every bone. You have to explain why it is a new species. Then that has to go through what is called peer review, which basically means other people in the industry get to read what you write. They get to do some research to find out if what you wrote is accurate, and if it is, and if it passes peer review, then we have a legitimate new species. And the name is determined by whoever describes it. And so it took 2 years in this case to be described after it was excavated in Alberta, Canada. Now, there's another member of the nodosaur family that is very common in the Canada area, and that is Edmontonia. At first, they thought this was just an Edmontonia, but closer details finally demonstrated that, no, it is indeed a new species of dinosaur. So it looks a lot like Edmontonia, but it's not exactly the same. What's amazing about this dinosaur is that almost its entire surface of its body was covered in plates. We call them osteoderms or scutes. What those mean are those are like pieces of bone that are embedded, stuck in the skin. They're not bones like of the skeleton. These are on the outside, but are sort of stuck in the skin. For instance, your fingernails are not part of your skeleton, but your fingernails are embedded in the skin and they grow. Well, that's what these osteoderms, or these plates or osteoderms or scutes are, is pieces of bone that cover the body that create armor. They basically are defensive armor. Now, with Panoplosaurus, this animal has so much coverage that there was even little pieces of bone in between these big plates that covered its back. Forrester family, correct. Sort of like armadillos have that. Turtles have that. And by the way, McAllister family, no. Pizzasaurus rex is not going to be a valid name. And Ameliorhaptor, stop saying it sounds delicious because it's not. So this is a very, very well-protected dinosaur. Now, all that body armor means that they're not fast, but they don't have to be, right? If you're in a tank, you don't have to race around 1,000 miles an hour because a tank protects you in war. Well, being an armored dinosaur, you have a lot of protection as well. And so it gives up speed in return for defense. And so this thing would have been slow. This would have been a very slow dinosaur. But again, no need to go anywhere fast. Something that's very interesting about ankylosaurs and nodosaurs. I'll call them ankylosaurs. That encompasses the whole family. Their teeth. Their teeth are shaped almost like little leaves. They look a lot like the teeth of iguanodons. Ankylosaurs, pachycephalosaurs, have very, very similar shaped teeth. It's sometimes hard to tell the difference between them. But what's interesting about these dinosaurs with these leaf-shaped teeth, the ankylosaurs' teeth show so much wear. They are ground down, in some cases, almost to the root. They're ground down, whereas other dinosaurs that have the same shape teeth don't have that problem. Here's why. Because ankylosaurs are built low to the ground. That means that they are limited to only eating vegetation that's low to the ground. And so that means that their snouts are closer to the dirt and more likely to pull up dirt when they're pulling up the plants to eat. And the dirt and the small rocks are ultimately grinding down their teeth. Whereas Pachycephalosaurus, they're up higher. They're not eating close to the ground. Therefore, they don't ingest as much dirt and rocks, which means that they don't grind their teeth down. Tori just asked a great question on the live feed. She said, would its babies go under its body for protection? Would a baby even have to? Very interesting question. Now, the fact that they come out of an egg would mean that if they have body armor, it's very soft because it has to be very flexible for the baby to be curled up inside of that egg, right? It's got to have a lot of flexibility, which means they probably come out with a very weak defense. So in my opinion, because they're not fast, I think the parent or parents would have to stay there to defend these things. They would have to stay there. I don't believe any nodosaur or ankylosaur would stand a chance of growing up if they just hatched and were abandoned. So that brings us into the question, well, what do they do? Yes, I fully believe that these dinosaurs, babies would know instinctively to go under the adults for protection. I absolutely believe that's what they would do. Their height would be tall enough for the babies to get under, but still low enough to stop a large predator from being able to go under there and do any damage. Because even though these animals are slow, they can still move around. And so isn't the feature creature also related to Antarctopelta? Yes, yes. Antarctopelta, I believe Amelioraptor is a true ankylosaur. But yeah, they're from that family, I'm almost sure. I believe he's an ankylosaur, I think. Anyway, so yeah, I think the babies would have gone under there for defense. I think they absolutely would have. Well, let's talk about their predators. There's a couple of big ones. Gorgosaurus and Diplodocus are the two big ones living in their environment. But there were a lot of smaller theropods. Now, Gorgosaurus and Diplodocus are not, they're both Tyrannosaurs. They're big. They're not going to be able to get low enough to get to the babies, and they wouldn't have the strength to push the adult over. So I think the babies are going to spend a lot of their time under mom and maybe even under dad. For all we know, the dads could be raising them. We don't know that. That's we don't know. But I think they definitely would have gone under there because they did live with a lot of medium and small predators. But the two big ones are Gorgosaurus and Diplodocus. I want to get back to talking about that skull. I told you it's very close to the ground. They sort of have a beak, sort of like a, it's not like a duckbill beak, but it's kind of flattened, sort of triangular shaped, made for cropping vegetation very low to the ground. But their head is low to the ground. Therefore, they're eating closer to the ground, and that puts them in more contact with dirt and ingesting it. But the nasal passage is what I want to talk about, because this is fantastic. Now, when I first loved dinosaurs, the idea of ever being able to see inside the skull of a dinosaur seemed impossible. Yes, they could clean the rock and dirt out, but I'm talking about seeing evidence of what was inside, what was in there. Well, one of the leading people is a very, very good friend of mine who I am honored to know, and that's Dr. Larry Whitmer. Professor Whitmer, they CAT scan these skulls, and a CAT scan is so strong. It's not like an X-ray. It's way stronger. A CAT scan can see through the rock and can pick up all the fine details of what used to be there. And so they can see the actual nasal passage. You would think that they simply have a nostril like humans. Goes in, goes through a couple of things, goes down to our lungs. Not the case. These guys have a very complex set of loops and tunnels that go through the skull. It's like, have you ever seen a crazy straw? When I was a kid, those were big. That's like a drinking straw that has loops and twists. And when you drink the liquid, it comes up and goes through all the different things to get to your mouth. That's sort of what's in the head of Panoplosaurus. But what that means is it allows for a lot of things to go on in there. It probably sort of helped enhance their sense of smell a little bit. But what it may have also done is if they are breathing cold air, by breathing that air through their nasal passage and it's traveling through all those loops, it begins to warm up. And therefore, it's not breathing cold air into its lungs. It's like breathing warm air, even when it's cold. But it could do another thing as well. When breathing out, instead of breathing out a lot of moisture from within its body, because when you breathe out, moisture leaves. When you talk, when you say anything, moisture is leaving. But by going through all those loops, it may have dried out, may have reclaimed that moisture and put it back into its system. So when it was breathing out dry air. We can't say with certainty what the function is, but we do know that that series of all those twists and turns, maybe it cooled the air when the air was hot. Maybe that's more likely what it was for. Whatever the case was, it's very interesting without any doubt. It's got all those twists and turns. I believe if you Google search Dr. Lawrence Whitmer, professor or Dr. Lawrence Whitmer at Ohio University, you can link to his lab page, or you can also find him on Facebook. You can link to the lab page and you can see these magnificent images of the things that they are doing using CAT scanning. So the nasal passage is remarkable to me in these animals. And my best guess is that it's not helping the sense of smell. Let me explain why I would think that. You would think with all those loops and turns, it would really help it pick up all the different things. It doesn't seem to be, because when they look at the actual brain, the part of the brain that's used for smell is called the olfactory bulb. And it's relatively small in this dinosaur. So I don't think it senses smell. I don't think it's using its sense of smell as much. So I believe that it has to do with the fact that it does not want to lose body moisture by either breathing in or out, because these animals are big and they're slow and they have to travel to find food and water. They don't want to be wasting water from their body by simply breathing out. They want to reclaim it. So I believe that that's what that thing is used for. Whatever the case is, this is a fascinating dinosaur. I absolutely love the nodosaurs. I think they would make great pets. If any of you would like to raise a dinosaur, I would suggest raising a nodosaur. All right, when I come back, let's answer some questions through AskDG. But first, let me cover this information about Patreon.
Become a member of the Dinosaur George Patreon Club and join the fun. We offer different club levels, each with their own set of benefits. Private lessons, new discoveries, behind-the-scene access, and much more are all part of being a club member. Visit DinosaurGeorge.com and sign up today.
Do you have any questions about dinosaurs? Just ask Dinosaur George. You can post your questions on the Dinosaur George Kids Facebook page or click on the Dinosaur George podcast page at dinosaurgeorge.com. Questions are chosen at random, and you can submit as many as you want. And now, here's Dinosaur George.
All right, let's jump into some of the questions that we have. This one comes from Raya Rex from Falls City, Washington. Wants to know if there were vegetables during the Cretaceous period. Yay! That's an interesting question. Yeah, there were. Absolutely, there were vegetables. Maybe not the kinds you and I would recognize. But things like potatoes are actually tubers, meaning they grow underground. And so I've got to stop real quick. Gemma, Susie Soros Rex, I am thrilled, absolutely thrilled that you guys are on this. I am absolutely thrilled. Thank you for the congratulations. I appreciate you so much. Anyway, getting back to this question, were there vegetables? So yeah, potatoes are what we call tubers, and those are things that grow underground. So they're not really roots necessarily. So yeah, I think there would have been a lot of those. I don't know if there's any evidence of a recognizable fruit today, meaning that the fruit that was our fruit or vegetables, they, like things like carrots and broccoli, those kind of things may have had something similar to them. But whatever the case, absolutely, absolutely, there would have been vegetables, what you and I consider vegetables, during the Cretaceous period. All right. Cha-Cha Hurricane Ben from Yorktown, Virginia, wants to know why Spinosaurus eats fish instead of other dinosaurs. This is a very good question. Okay, I've said this before, and I don't know if I've said this on a podcast, but every environment is like its own little building, right? Like every environment has a building, and there are residents in the building. There are certain trees that grow there. There are certain plants that grow there. They have certain kind of weather. There are certain amount of plant eaters and omnivores and carnivores. But no matter how big the building is, the food sources are limited. There's not endless food. There has to be a balance between plant eaters, plants, and meat eaters. So when you have a giant meat eater like Spinosaurus living in one of those buildings, living with that dinosaur is Carcharodontosaurus, another gigantic carnivore. Now you have two giant meat eaters living in the same building, the same environment. The only way that's going to happen is if they divide the food source, where one eats something, the other eats something different. So by dividing the food source, Spinosaurus can focus its attention on aquatic food. Carcharodontosaurus can focus its attention on terrestrial food. They certainly would overlap if Carcharodontosaurus happened to walk up on a fish that was trapped in shallow water and eat it in a heartbeat. If Spinosaurus happens to see an herbivore within attack space, it's going to attack it. But basically, they have divided the food source, and that is what allows them to be able to live within the same environment. All right, George Allosaurus would like to know if you could tell us more about being a paleo artist as a career. This is a great question. Paleo art is a career. When you see these drawings of dinosaurs and you see these scientific images, those are very important to science because somebody has to draw them. When you see books with beautiful imagery, somebody drew or painted that. Somebody created that. Now, paleo artists, some are specialized. That means that's really what they focus on. And they focus all of their attention on drawing bones, drawing illustrations for books, for scientific research, for description. When people describe dinosaurs, a new species, they have to have things to go along with that. So the job of a paleo artist can be a very successful one. A lot of people that draw paleo art also do other things. A very good friend of mine, Richard Bonk, he is a comic book artist. He draws amazing art of different various things for books, for movies, for all kinds of stuff. But he also draws dinosaurs. So a paleo artist can be specialized in only paleo art, or they can be an artist who draws for paleontologist. But that could be a very good career choice. If you are somebody that has an ability to draw or create quality art, there's good opportunities for you. So George Allosaurus, if you like drawing, that would be a very good job for you to pursue. All right. Javisaurus Rex would like to know why dinosaurs were warm-blooded instead of cold-blooded like reptiles. You guys asked a brilliant question. By the way, all of these questions that I'm reading, these all came from our Patreon Club members this time. We periodically only answer questions from Patreon Club members. Now, if you are on our Dinosaur George Facebook group page, the Dinosaur George Kids page, sometimes I go on there and I read those questions on a podcast as well. But today I'm just reading all of these. Okay, Javisaurus Rex, why were they warm-blooded instead of cold-blooded? It's a very interesting question, and there's still a lot of debate. Were they really warm-blooded? Were they cold-blooded? Or were they something in between? We call dino-blooded. For those of you that may not know what those terms mean, warm-blooded humans, we are warm-blooded. We create our own body heat by the food that we take in. We convert it to energy, and that's what keeps us warm. Cold-blooded animals like snakes and lizards, they rely on the sun to warm up their body for them. And so the difference is a warm-blooded animal can be up and moving at all temperatures, at all hours. Cold-blooded animals don't have that ability. Most of the time, in the winter or at night, they may not be as active because their body loses heat and they can't warm up unless the sun is shining. So with dinosaurs, if they were cold-blooded, the idea that they would have to stand out in the sun to warm up would almost be implausible. And what I mean by that, Javisaurus, what I mean by that is if a Brachiosaurus had to stand in the sun to get warm, it would take the entire day to warm it up. And then once it was warm, nightfall would begin and they wouldn't be able to get around to take advantage of it. So dinosaurs were becoming more advanced. In fact, the question isn't why were they warm-blooded instead of cold-blooded? It was how did that help them? And the fact that when they were showing up and evolving, that warm-blooded tendency gave them an advantage over the cold-blooded, and that's why dinosaurs took over the world for so many millions of years. 100 million years, 200 million years, they existed because of being able to live in other environments. We find dinosaurs living in what was the polar regions, where it would have been incredibly cold during the winter, and yet they're living there. So that's a pretty good indication. So why were they? Because they evolved, and that gave them an advantage over all other animals of their time. All right, Giganota Gibson wants to know, we all know your favorite dinosaur is Allosaurus, but what are your second and third favorites? P.S. I love your podcast. Thank you, Giganota Gibson. That's very kind of you. So Allosaurus is my favorite. If I had to choose a second place, I would say Utah Raptor, and third would be Deinonychus, but I'll tell you, I changed so many times because I really like the Ankylosaurs and the Ceratopsians. You know, the in order, it's Theropod, Ankylosaur, Ceratopsian, followed by Sauropod, Hadrosaurs. Those are my favorites. That's my favorite. I don't like all meat eaters better, but I do like mostly I like the carnivores. So that's a good one. All right. Spinosaurus, age 6, from Nashville, Tennessee, wants to know what we would know the strength of Titanoboa's squeeze. Whoa! This is a good one. What do we know about the squeeze? Well, we use modern animals as a way to understand prehistoric life. We rely on modern animals to help us understand prehistoric life. And what I mean by that is that, hang on, just switch something real quick. What I mean by that is we take an animal like an elephant and we estimate, we can visually see how fast they can run. Then we can use that number to then help us understand how fast another four-legged dinosaur would run, like Triceratops. How fast could it run? Well, elephants and Triceratops are not the same thing, but there are ways we can use the elephant speed to help us better understand the Triceratops speed. So when it comes to the squeeze of Titanoboa, we would then compare it to anacondas or boa constrictors. And they can measure the squeezing capacity of those snakes, modern ones. So then we could say, if Titanoboa is 5 times larger than, if he's 5 times larger than the anaconda, then its squeeze might be 5 times stronger. Now, that doesn't mean that works all the time because there's different things. But scientists and mathematicians are able to work together to come up with some sort of idea of the power and the strength that goes into that body. So we find the rib bone of Titanoboa and we compare it to the size of the rib bone of the anaconda. We measure the anaconda squeeze and then we increase it to the size of the rib compared to the rib of the anaconda. I hope this is not confusing to everybody. I hope it's not too terribly confusing, but that's basically what they do. And from that, I could only tell you that the squeeze is strong enough to probably stop a Tyrannosaurus Rex from breathing. It's never going to eat a Tyrannosaurus Rex. It can't. It simply can't open its jaws wide enough to swallow a Tyrannosaurus Rex, an adult. But it may be able to apply enough pressure to squeeze hard enough to basically stop Tyrannosaurus from breathing and kill it. So I don't know what that would be in a number, but I do know that that number could at least be what we call it extrapolation. They could extrapolate by taking a modern animal and measuring it and then applying it to the animal that was prehistoric and either increasing it or decreasing it compared to the size of the two. I hope that makes sense. Okay. Phoebe Cephalosaurus wants to know, do you think dinosaurs made it for life? You guys have such great questions. You have such wonderful questions. That's a brilliant question. Birds have evolved from the raptor dinosaurs. And a lot of modern birds will mate for life. A lot of them will mate for life. That's a behavior that came from somewhere. Did it come from their ancestors, the dinosaurs? Hey, Percher family, how are you guys? There's my virtual hug. Did it come from them? Or did modern birds evolve that behavior recently? We don't know. We do know that they do find some species of dinosaurs die together in a group. And that would then tell us that at least they were together when they died. There's a lot of benefits to finding a mate and staying with that mate for life. But there's also some negatives to that. What it means is that if you find a mate, the offspring you create are going to have the features of parents, both parents. So they're not cookie cutter images, but they're very, very similar to them. in a species, you want a lot of diversity. And the reason for that is if we all have the same parents, we might all be susceptible to one kind of disease that may not bother other dinosaurs, but it could bother our family, just our family. So we could be wiped out. But if you mate with different members, you have different kind of behaviors and different parts of another animal. So for instance, if this male Tyrannosaurus and this male female Tyrannosaurus are mated for life, their offspring are going to have their combined features and behaviors. And that might be good. But what if it's not good? Then that entire family could go extinct quickly. But if this female has this mate this year and a different mate another year, her offspring are going to be hers, but they're going to have different things about them. And that might be good for the species. So I don't know if they mated for life. I don't know. Because the good in being mated for life is good in one aspect, because the way a female usually chooses a male is by recognizing that that male is very healthy. And so the female has chosen the best of the best. And maybe that's better than randomly picking the best of whoever was there during the time that she was receptive to finding a mate. So it's a mind-boggling question. It's a brilliant question. I'm going to say that I do not think they mated for life. I'm going to say that my opinion, based on the behavior I see of modern animals, is that although some birds will mate for life, not all of them will. And so therefore that behavior is only applied to some species of birds. So it probably doesn't go back to the dinosaurs. Because if it did, then most likely all birds would have that behavior, but they don't. So I'm going to say, no, I do not think they did. But that was an absolutely brilliant question, and I loved it. Emilio Raptor just sent me through the live feed that I'm doing. He said, were dinosaurs that had bioluminescent? I don't know if that is something we will ever know, Emilio. I don't know if we can know that or not, because I don't know. All bioluminescence, from my understanding, is something that has to do with the skin. It's with the cell structure itself within the skin. And that doesn't fossilize. At least we haven't found it yet that I'm aware of. So if they did, it would certainly serve a purpose. Because remember I said dinosaurs were warm-blooded enough to function during the both day and night? Bioluminescence serves a purpose at night. It's certainly possible that they could. Now, I am unaware of any modern reptile that has bioluminescence. Fish do, a lot of insects do. But I'm unaware of any reptile that does. If any of you that are watching the live feed can jump on your computer and type to see, are there any reptiles that demonstrate bioluminescence? That would be interesting to me. But let's say that they did. Well, I think it would be an effective method of communication at night, or a lure to draw something in to be eaten. What if the inside of a Majungatholus had Majungasaurus had a bioluminescence? And it just laid its body on the ground and opened its mouth and waited for something to go investigate. Wouldn't that be crazy? Majungatholus? Is it Majungatholus or Majungasaurus? They combine the two to be, I want to say Majungatholus. I hate that I use it as an example because now I don't know. All right. That's a very, very good question. That's an excellent question. Okay. Let's see. Now, this is interesting. This is from the Foster family. Could Pachycephalosaurus's hard head break? Absolutely it could. As a matter of fact, do you know that They find on pachycephalosaurs these injuries to the dome. And some scientists suggest that that's due to headbutting with others. But others believe that that might be injuries caused by hunting. Some people believe that pachycephalosaurs were omnivorous and maybe using their head to knock something down or defending itself. But whatever the case, there's definitely damage to the dome. That dome in the big pachycephalosaurus wyomingensis, that's 9 inches thick of solid bone. So it probably is never going to crack, but it's certainly going to be chipped or damaged. They definitely do have that. It's a good question. Susie Soros would like to know which ceratopsian had the best defense. She says hi to everyone and hopes everyone is okay. For those of you that don't know, Gemma and Susie Soros, and Susie Soros inherited this from her mom, are some of the most kind people you'll ever want to meet. And it's so funny because so many times, Susie Soros, I see these pictures of her doing so many things with friends, and they're such kind people. And so for Susie Soros to say hi to everybody, she means hi to everybody. They live over in England, by the way. She is my adopted niece. I just tell everybody she's my niece. So they're over in England. So which ceratopsian had the best defenses? This is a good question. Because Pachyrhinosaurus doesn't seem to have a horn on its nose. And yet, that's a very successful dinosaur being around for a long time, and lots of them. So does the horn necessarily give you the best defense, or is there something else? Could their sense of vision or sense of smell be what really helps them with the defense? Or is it the horns? So my thoughts would be this. I believe, Susie Soros, that Styracosaurus demonstrates all the things necessary to be successful. Triceratops, you can't not recognize. It's living with Tyrannosaurus Rex. It's living with Tyrannosaurus. It definitely has enough defense to last that monster. But I think Styracosaurus, because those gigantic spikes sticking up from the frill would protect it from attack from above. And that lone single horn on the nose would be a very effective way to be able to defend themselves. So in my opinion, I think that would be the answer. I'm going to go with Styracosaurus. But Triceratops would be the next one in line, simply because who and what it is living with. All right, let's jump into some Who Would Wins.
Who push would win? Button. What if two different prehistoric creatures fought? Who would win? T-Rex versus a giant wolf? Raptor versus terror bird? Spinosaurus versus Triceratops. You choose the animals, and Dinosaur George will size them up and pick a winner. Now, get ready. It's time to find out who would win.
Real quick, on the live feed, my very good friend Hugo just said, a couple of years ago, Dakota Raptor was discovered. Was this an actual raptor and the biggest of the raptors? So far, it appears to be the case. It appears, hang on, my camera just went out of focus. Those of you listening can't hear it, but how weird is this? What just happened? That's really weird. Hang on a second. There, that's weird. My camera just suddenly went out of focus. I just noticed on the live feed that the camera went completely out of focus. I don't know what happened. But anyway, I don't know if Dakota Raptor has been accepted as a legitimate member of the Raptor group, but it appears that more and more pieces are being found and more bones are now being attributed to it. And so I understand that it is, if it hasn't been, it's probably going to be listed as one of the biggest, if not the biggest member of the raptor family. All right, the Who Would Wins. This comes from Javi Bing. Tarbosaurus versus Nanuksaurus. Interesting, two tyrannosaurs. Tarbosaurus has size, bite force, and power on its side. Nanuksaurus probably has speed. Probably has speed on its side. And that's going to be effective to stay out of the jaws. But the problem is, you still got to come in for an actual bite. And when you do, Tarbosaurus has those jaws waiting for you. and they are going to be, they're going to be lethal at a moment's bite. So I would give that particular fight to Tarbosaurus. All right. My little Susie Saurus says, who would win? Mammoth versus T-Rex. I like this fight. I like it. And here's why. Mammoth's bodies were compact, meaning there's a big lot of power in a small area. Not that they were small, but compact. They're not elongated. And that gives them the ability to hit something and maintain its ground, meaning its body doesn't fly off to the side. It can stand its ground with so much force. The tusks are not necessarily going to be effective weapons because they curve up. So they're not really going to stab. Well, depending on the species you're talking about, they're not really going to stab. So with Tyrannosaurus Rex, being knocked to the ground is a very good way to get away from it, because it's going to take it a while to get back up, and it runs the risk of breaking bones if it hits the ground. So if Tyrannosaurus lowers his head and comes rushing in for an attack, with the mammoth, that power is going to be like running into a building. It's not going to go anywhere. It's just going to be, it's going to be a stationary object. And something's got to give when a moving object hits a stationary object, something's got to give. And what could give would be the neck bones of the Tyrannosaurus, or potentially being knocked down. So this is an interesting one because it's hard to judge with so many different factors. But the one thing that's going for Tyrannosaurus Rex, just like with Tarbosaurus, are those massive teeth and the gigantic bite force. They could penetrate the hide of a mammoth and they could cause incredible amount of damage. So I would give it to Tyrannosaurus Rex. Gus Raptor wants to know, Mapposaurus versus Carcharodontosaurus, two very closely related dinosaurs. I believe Mapposaurus is a little smaller than Carcharodontosaurus, but not much. They are probably evenly matched. These dinosaurs are evenly matched. I honestly would say, in this case, it would be the flip of a coin. I honestly believe it would be, it would be that hard to guess, because this is a very evenly matched group. It's a very good fight. That one's tough. You stumped me on that one. All right. Megalodon says woolly rhino versus saber-toothed cat versus woolly mammoth versus mastodon. You guys are loving these Pleistocene animals. Loving them. Okay. Let's see. Woolly rhino, saber-toothed cat, woolly mammoth, mastodon. All right. Right away, the saber-tooth is not going to stand up to this group. It's the first to go. Woolly rhino could dispatch him pretty quick. So that then leaves the rhino, the mammoth, and the mastodon. Because we are fighting two animals that absolutely live in the colder environment, mastodon is not going to have a chance. Mastodon's not going to have a chance. Doesn't have the same footing, doesn't have the same capabilities. If the fight were in the hotter region, then the rhino and the mammoth would overheat pretty quick. Mastodon would have an advantage. But in this case, we're going to assume that the mastodon is the next to go. That leaves the woolly rhino and the mammoth. We've seen fights between elephant and rhino playing out before our eyes in Africa. And it never ends good for the rhino. And it wouldn't end good for this this rhino either. So in my opinion, the mammoth, I think, is going to be the one that's going to win. All right, the Forster family, Stegosaurus versus Triceratops. I like this matchup a lot because you have a Jurassic and a Cretaceous herbivore both going at it. The benefit of Stegosaurus is, of course, the tail. That's its number one weapon. Triceratops has the horns. Here's the difference. The tail can only be used if the animal turns quickly enough to get it in the right position to assault the attacker. If the attack comes from the front, the animal has to quickly turn its body and position itself to where it could swing the tail and hit the attacker. Whereas with Triceratops, those horns are pointing forward. And that gives Triceratops the ability to assault at what it's looking at, not having to turn its body. If an attack comes, well, it turns its body if the attack comes, but the horns are already in the perfect position for defense. With Stegosaurus, it has to turn its body, but it has to turn sideways to the attacker to get the tail in position. And that is not a good way to defend yourself when you're by yourself. That's why I think Stegosaurus lived and traveled together, because by themselves, two Allosauruses could take care of them very quickly. But if there's more than one Stegosaurus, no matter how many Allosauruses there are, you've got tails aiming in all directions. So in this particular case, I would say that it's going to be Triceratops. All right. James E. Rex and Johnosaurus Rex want to know who would win, mountain lion versus short-faced bear. Interesting. Modern animal taking on an Ice Age animal. Short-faced bear is a monstrosity. It's got all the power. It's got all the abilities. It lived with the dire wolves, and it lived with the saber-toothed cats, the big ones, the saber-toothed lions. It lived with the American lion and had no problem doing so. Therefore, it is so advanced that I think it would win without any doubt. Starviraptor. Starviraptor wants to know Leviathan versus Megalodon. Whale versus shark. Megalodon has the advantage. Here's why. Leviathan has a bigger brain. Warm-blooded, capable of fighting anything, massive teeth. But Megalodon never has to come up for air. And that is the deciding factor in these battles, I believe. Not having to come up for air gives you an advantage. But I will say this. I recently watched a video of killer whales killing a great white shark. The great white shark, if it had just dove deep and continued to go deep, the killer whales wouldn't have been able to follow. But it didn't. It stayed up near the surface and it was destroyed by these killer whales. So that can happen. But I believe something may have been wrong with that great white shark, because it didn't try to evade. And they may have sensed that, and that may be why they attacked it. They may have sensed that that shark, something was not right. It was sick. Something was going on with it, because it did not in the video appear to evade at all. So we can't say that that then is definitive proof that whales beat sharks. But there was one incident of that. But in the case that you sent me, I'm going to go with Megalodon. All right. My assistant Noah wants to know Leviathan versus Megalodon. Wrong line. Noah wants to know Ceratosaurus versus Baryonyx. I like this one. I like this one quite a bit. This is a pretty good one. Ceratosaurus versus Baryonyx. Very interesting choice. Ceratosaurus being a much more archaic dinosaur, meaning it was an earlier dinosaur, probably mid to late Jurassic, whereas Baryonyx is mid to late Cretaceous. There's always an advantage in a newer, more recent animal. It's got so much more in its behaviors learned by previous generations. So the longer you live, the smarter you become, basically. Ceratosaurus has four-fingered claws, which Baryonyx only has three. Ceratosaurus absolutely has it at speed. But there is one other thing I want to add. One day, I was having lunch with Dr. Robert Bakker, and Dr. Bakker told me that ceratosaurs are much larger than we think. That the evidence he looked at were always showing these ceratosaurs as being 15 feet long, where he's saying that they may have eclipsed 30 to 35 and may have been a direct assault on Allosauruses. So I'm basing this off of my knowledge of Ceratosaurus as it is today, which doesn't show to be giant. But there's the possibility that we haven't found the big ones yet. So for right now, I would say Baryonyx has all the advantages. But if it's ever shown that a Ceratosaurus grew to the sizes that they think they could, then I think it would have easily won. All right, Amelioraptor wanted to know Indominus Rex and Indoraptor teaming up against Gigantopithecus and Gastornis. So two hybrid dinosaurs and two Cenozoic animals. Gigantopithecus being a giant snake and Gastornis being a giant bird. Interesting concept, interesting fight, but Indominus and Indoraptor are simply too much. They're just too much. No, they don't have the knowledge and skills of animals passed down over the years, but their sheer size compensates for that. I would give it to Team Indominus Rex. So Team Indo wins this one. Then Logan Raptor said, Ankylosaurus versus Dodicarus. Dodicarus is a mammal that lived in the, I think, Pliocene or Pleistocene. It's an animal like a giant armadillo with a big shell on its back, but it also has a spiky tail, which is a very good weapon. Ankylosaurus is simply so gigantic that it would win without any problems at all, I think. I think that would be what I would go with. All right, Hugo wants to know, full-grown Albertosaurus versus a subadult T-Rex. Man, this would be an interesting one. I would give it to the Albertosaurus, even though the subadult is going to have a tremendously powerful bite force. I would give it to the Albertosaurus simply because as an adult, it absolutely has all of the knowledge that comes with being an adult. And then finally, Tori says City Patty versus Oviraptor. Man, this is an interesting one. City Patty's got the advantage, I believe. I personally believe City Patty has the advantage in this particular case. And I would say that that would be the winner in this particular fight. All right, my friends, that does it for this podcast. I hope you all enjoyed it. Thank you all so very much. I will try to do more live feeds as I do these. And I tell you what I'll do. I will pick a time and date. I will pick a time and date, and I will announce it on an upcoming podcast of when I'm going to go live so that all of you can take advantage of it. I didn't give any notice. I just jumped on. So I will do that. Also, I am trying to set aside time to start doing personal private lessons via Zoom again this summer. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it, but I'm going to try. So for those of you that have been asking me, that have been wanting to have a private lesson, I'm not able to do them right now, but I hope to be able to do them this summer. So I will keep you all posted. Remember, everybody, be kind to everybody out there. Be nice. Help people that need help. If you see someone that is struggling with a personal issue, let them know you're a friend. You may not know how much comfort you bring to them when they know that a stranger or someone they've never met cares about them. It helps a bunch. Be kind, everybody. Keep studying. Keep digging for clues. And I will see you all very, very soon.
Thank you for listening to Dinosaur George Kids. Join the Dinosaur George Kids Facebook group, become a member of our Patreon club, and check out our website store for cool fossils, rocks, and crystals. Visit dinosaurgeorge.com for details. Until next time, keep digging for knowledge.